the other kids as he masticated that slice. The other kids would just go crazy with jealousy at the lunch tables and heads would explode. And this was a sick ritual that would start all over again the next day, day after day for years. I am sure that this is where whoever wrote The Hunger Games got the idea. I should look up if she went to country school. And I will say that years later, at every meal, even if I have food in front of me, I watch what everyone else has. The other day at breakfast, this lady ordered the smoked salmon I had contemplated before going with the eggs and sausage instead. When her plate came, I could hear the music start to rise in my head and feel my eyes zeroing in on her plate. It looked so good. God damn it! I turned to my husband, and before I could even speak, he knew exactly what I was up to. It's as if I become Lou Ferrigno in The Incredible Hulk and I start bulging up when I covet food and I need to be talked down. I covet to this day, and that is why my friends still call me the seagull. I have that desperate look in my eyes, and yet it is pointed, not sad. However, there is good news, and the moral of this tale for me is that I will assemble my daughter's school lunches with love and detail. I will labor with bento box style precision. It is going to be a chance for me to do it the exact way I would have dreamed of when I was a kid, when I became the seagull in the first place. But don't worry. Seagulls are no chumps, and neither am I. Toddette. My partner Nancy and I had always talked about driving across the country. We'd always say to each other, we have to go on a road trip and we have to go in an RV. We had fantasies of one of us driving while the other one scrapbooked at the table. Sleeping wherever we damn well pleased, flipping quarters at desolate intersections somewhere in the great USA and saying, should we go right or go left? I don't know. Let's flip a quarter. This was a fantasy we discussed for a few years until one night in 1996. I called her up late and said, you know, we can keep talking about this or we can actually go do it. And I say we just go rent an RV in the morning and go. And much to my happiness, she said yes, and we did just that. Our plan was to go from Los Angeles to Wolfboro, New Hampshire, where Nan's family had a lake house, taking whatever route seemed fun in the moment. We would be on the open road for 1 month. Let the games begin. We packed our bags, my dogs, cameras, notebooks, and anything else we needed. On our first night, we were driving through Palm Springs, and at a checkout stand at the grocery store, we heard the checkout lady say to the customer in front of us, you gonna go see the meteor shower in the monument tonight? We quickly found out that the monument was Joshua Tree. We parked our wonderful RV, which we called the Tioga, after the name of the model. We let the dogs go roam, and we climbed up the stairs on the back, the ones where, when you're driving behind an RV on the freeway, you think, why are there stairs back there? We lay down on the roof on our backs and stared up at the sky. I took out my old camera and went with a long, long, long open exposure and waited for something to happen. To this day, I have never seen anything like this. All of a sudden, it started to rain stars as if the sky had turned into a shower and the universe was giving us a cleansing from the heavens above. Not bad for night one. Next, we went through White Sands National Monument, Fredericksburg, Texas, all along the southern coast of the country. And a few weeks in, we decided, New Orleans! I've never been, so why not? Had we thought it out, we probably wouldn't have rolled into the outskirts of town in the middle of the night. Being a stupid girl in my 20s, I just didn't think of dangers like that. And so I decided to pull the RV into the gas station and fill her up. Nan was somewhere in the back, and the dogs were sleeping on the bed. It was a typical night in our weeks-long routine. Until the crushing sound. Cringe! Of ripping metal. I looked up in shock as I realized that I had underestimated the height of the gas station roof over the pumps and lodged myself under it as our RV ripped through the metal overhang. Oops. After the loud thunder, there was a moment of silence. And I do mean a moment. And then all of a sudden, we heard a shrieking, squawking voice coming out of the glass cashier box. It was distorted due to the fact that the woman was screaming through an old microphone. Crackling, clucking shrills filled the air, and she was yelling words so fast at such a high pitch I couldn't understand what she was saying. I wondered why she wasn't coming out of there as I moved through the RV to the side door and checked everyone's status. Everyone was fine. No one was remotely hurt. This was just awkward. The lady screamed again. But why wasn't she getting out? I opened the side door and then I saw her. She looked like a cartoon. A very large woman who apparently could not move or refused to try. Crazy, wiry black hair and drugstore makeup. She just sat on her tuffet in the glass box, screaming her piece, and her piece finally became clear through the muffled chaos. I'm calling the cops! They're on their way! Don't even think about leaving! Shit. Okay, no problem. I finally got a look from the right perspective at the damage, and the situation was this. Our roof and the overhang had simply become one. They were cats cradled together, and it wasn't clear how you can untangle it, so to speak. As Nan and I looked around, we started to take in our surroundings in all directions. Dark alleys, trash cans on fire. I think there was possibly a tumbleweed. It was clear that we were in one seriously rough neighborhood. I started to panic. It wasn't even the roof that had me shaken up anymore. I started to wonder if the woman in the box couldn't lift herself up or if she knew that leaving the glass box wasn't safe. Shit! I was scared. And just then, a figure started coming toward us out of the shadows. He slinked toward us, going from backlit silhouette to an even stranger stringy person with dainty wrists and greasy long hair as he started to come into focus. The person looked like a he, but in some form of drag. Negligee slip, flip-flops. But the most important detail on top of this pipe cleaner of a man was that he was wearing pearls. Perfect. As this creature sauntered over to us, he uttered his first words, and they came out in a long, flowing southern drawl. Y'all better get the fuck out. As we stood there wondering if he was friend or foe, threat or our latest ally, he looked us straight down the barrel of our eyes. You ladies really better get the fuck out. And he started moving his hands like an airplane conductor on the tarmac, insinuating we birds needed to fly away. The woman continued to shout over the entire exchange. Yeah, we're stuck, I said. And he looked at me with a calm, knowing look. He didn't have to say, yes, stupid girl, I see that. Instead, he went straight to the bottom line. The cops aren't gonna help. The cops are the ones you should fear. I took in this information. Oh, God, I muttered. Now I was really flipping out. Nan was in the RV making sure that all of our business was in order, license, registration, etc. She was a practical person, getting everything organized and perfect, and I was the one outside crumbling. In the darkness, the trash cans were on fire as if someone had turned them up. The whole scene was starting to turn into the Michael Jackson Thriller video. Figures were coming out of the cracks and from behind abandoned buildings. I ran back to the RV. Nan, we have got to get this fucking thing unlodged. He says we're in danger, but I think that's becoming glaringly obvious. I ran to the driver's seat and hopped in. I poked my head out the window and said to the mysterious person, if I try to get myself out from under this, can you help? He nodded, as if I was finally starting to wise up. I asked him my next frantic question. What's your name? He looked at me and said with a Blanche DuBois delivery, Toddette. Of course. Nan and Toddette each took a place outside, her in the front of the RV, him in the back. I could see her out the windshield and him in the side mirror. The dogs were still hanging out on the bed, staring at me. I pulled the gear down and started to slowly put my foot on the gas. Meanwhile, the woman's squawks again turned into, don't even think about moving! I called the cops! They're on their way! The RV didn't move, so I applied a little more pressure. Nan guiding me from the front like a beacon of all things sane and Toddette nodding small nods over and over. Nothing. No movement. The cops are coming! She screamed again. My heart was pounding. I wasn't going to flee the cops. I just wanted to not be stuck when they got here. According to Toddette, this was crucial. You better get the fuck out. As if the clock was ticking and the zombies were coming! According to the surroundings, being a sitting duck was a fool's choice. Okay, I said to myself, I have to stab it, floor it, anything! Watch out! I jammed the gas. The RV finally lurched forward and I flew out in a flash. I heard a giant rip and I looked in the rearview mirror just in time to see, as if in slow motion, the entire air conditioning system fly off the top and over the back onto the concrete in a perfect rainbow arching crash. And then I saw Nan and Toddette run to it, each take a side, and crab walk it to the side door and into the belly of the RV, where there was now a giant gaping hole in the ceiling. It was surreal to see Toddette in the living room of our mobile home, comforting in a strange way. This strung-out drag queen had become some kind of guardian angel. With his simple wisdom, I did get the fuck out, and it was the first sigh of relief I had in the last 30 minutes. After a minute, the woman in the box realized that we weren't running away, and she took it down half an octave, and we had a minute to small talk with Toddette. Eventually, the cops did come. I wondered what had taken them so long, and then I realized that despite this woman in the box screaming her lungs out for an hour straight, around these parts, this is probably not a high-priority case for these officers. Two idiots stuck in a gas station must be small potatoes compared to some of the calls these guys were getting. I noticed Toddette starting to recoil and shuffle slowly backwards when the cops arrived. I started to feel so sad. Had he just seen too much? Had he been discriminated against so hard? What abuse had led him to these parts and this life? He went from my new hero to someone I wanted to rescue. The cops took our information down and referred us to a place that could fix our RV. As they were driving away, I turned to Toddette and said, is there anything you need? Anything I can do? Nan came up with some cold, hard cash and handed it to him. Again, she is so smart. Toddette wouldn't have benefited from my crisis hotline style of care. He could just use the money for whatever it was he needed. I shudder to think. Well, thank you truly, Toddette. You really helped us out of a jam. I heard the engine turn over, and once again, Practical Nan was getting a move on. I walked to the RV and looked back as I saw him slink into the night in his lace slip and flip-flops. Who knows? Maybe he would buy more pearls. Days later, somewhere in Tennessee, we needed to have some money wired to us from Western Union. Let's just say Cajun campers had cleaned us out in repair bills for fixing the hole in the roof. When we were asked at a payphone what name to put the money order under, Nan and I both looked at each other and, without missing a beat, said in unison, Toddette. Klutz. Oh! I just poured an entire bottle of water all over the counter because I missed the cup somehow. I fell down the stairs this morning. Yesterday, my new stroller, which is apparently back heavy, fell over. Luckily, my daughter Olive was walking next to me. Her weight would have stabilized it, but it happened walking out of this restaurant where everyone was staring at me. I was so embarrassed. I looked back and they were all baffled. I knock everything over. I trip, I fall, I tear, I spill, I break. Why? Will I ever grow into a graceful person, or will I always be the lame duck that is in a rush? I also find myself apologizing every 2 seconds. Oh God, sorry. Or, excuse me? Or, quickly recovering. Oh no, that didn't hurt. I'm okay. Are you okay? When I step on people's feet or walk into people, where is my head at, let alone my eyes? Will life always be this way? When I was 7 years old, I went on The Tonight Show for the first time, and when I walked out to go up on the stage, I slipped and totally ate it. I think that was the first time I recall feeling humiliated. People said it was cute, but inside, I knew I simply couldn't put one foot in front of the other as well as I should. But I had no idea that I would endure a lifelong incapacity to ever be cool. When I was in the schoolyard, there was no denying that I simply didn't possess any ability for agility either, as I was always last to be picked for a sporty game. I understood. And although it made me look like a loser, I actually agreed with those team captains. You don't want me. My mother put me in all kinds of lessons when I was a kid. Piano, I wasn't musical. Tennis, nope, not an athlete. Ballet, don't get me started. That is a cruel world for girls. It's a cliche and tough, and I hated it. I was short with boobs and no grace. So yeah, I wasn't delusional about my non-starter career as a ballerina. Like I said, the only thing budding happening to me was in my chest. Karate was fun and strangely the one thing I really loved. I loved that the boys in the class didn't make me feel bad about myself. They were just as tough on me and I loved hitting back, sparring, getting higher belts of new colors. In karate, I was getting somewhere, and I didn't dread getting out of the car to go. I had a skip in my step. I liked fighting. I liked being tough. Then my mother forced me to go to dance class. Okay, this was the ultimate screw job. The teacher, Julie O'Connell, and the Julie O'Connell dancers, as we would now be referred to, were required to wear spandex unitards. It was 1984, and so those were common back then. It doesn't mean it looked good. And she actually made jackets that said, The Julie O'Connell Dancers on the back. They were disco-rific, satin with gold writing, and if there was one souvenir I could have from those years, it would be that jacket. If anyone ever comes across it, please find me. But in that class, Julie would simply have no problem comparing the girls as we danced around and learned routines. It was as if we were being pitted against each other. And later in life, I would become so protective of girls having each other's backs, and I think it's due to some of these experiences. Schools and youth can be a time when everyone is getting their sea legs. Girls learn that they have to stick together, but I don't think that lesson comes without painful youth isolation. Anyway, there were always these girls who were more graceful, more capable, physically speaking, better looking in unitards, period. I was stumpy and clumsy. I didn't have the moves. And the only one I did well at was kicking and punching. That would actually come in handy later. I just didn't know it at the time. Thank you, Charlie's Angels. And one day, I would be a cover girl. And then I would own my own beauty business. But again, we just don't know what the future is when we're young. I have grown past some things, but I do know that I have never shed my klutziness. Every day there will be an incident. Every day there will be some humiliation. Every day there will be damage to something or someone, just hopefully not too bad. I think it stems from a bit of stupidity too, I have to admit. When I am trying to balance and carry something at the same time, that is not smart, and it will cause me to spill or trip or drop something. When I am trying to reach that plate high up on the top shelf, what do I expect? When I am trying to multitask, let's say walking as I put the shoe on rather than sitting down and dealing, yes, I might eat it. If I'm rushing the zipper, I might get some skin. If I'm talking on the phone while running around my bathroom trying to get out of the house like a mad chicken, I might break something. When does it change? Do I need to become a calm, slow, mature, clear-headed charm school graduate and simplify my whole life? Is this even possible? Interestingly enough, I now dance voluntarily at the same studio as the one I was forced to as a kid. I am now a willing woman at my fun, sweaty hip-hop hipster dance class, and I finally feel good. I dance with complete abandon. I own it. The whole silly package. It's true when they say, just wait 20 years and it will all be better. It was a long time to wait, but they were actually right. Germany. I haven't thought about this in so long, but even so, it haunts me daily. When I was 11 years old, I went to Munich to make a made-for-TV movie/Christmas special called Babes in Toyland, a sort of live-action Mother Goose type of story that had a large cast, including a young up-and-coming Keanu Reeves, and we were there for many months, around 4 or 5. We shot on the Bavarian sound stages where they made such films as Das Boot, and we lived near Schwabing, which was a lively shopping district and beer garden area. I really have no idea how or why I was given such a long leash, but I could go anywhere I wanted by myself, and I loved it. In the film, lots of people in animal costumes were needed, so they hired a bunch of American teenagers from the local army base they could get for reasonable money, and it was the kids' summer break, so it worked out for everybody. I was thrilled to be around a bunch of teenagers who knew what it was like to move around and live an unorthodox life. It was 1986, and heavy metal was alive and well, and it was the soundtrack to that summer. Songs by bands like Van Halen, Rat, Judas Priest were the ones that color my memories. We would all make each other mixtapes and share music. When I wasn't working, I would go to the areas where people could do two things, hang out and drink. For some reason, it was very easy to get alcohol whenever and wherever we needed it. I think the drinking age was 18 and some of the kids were 16, and it all just kind of came out in the wash. And that's what we did, sit around, get drunk, and listen to heavy metal. But one night, a rock band came through the hotel. They were on tour, and somehow I made friends with someone, and sure enough, we got to go see their concert. It was so much fun, and after, of course, in another night of drinking kids, we ran through the hotel, and once we got back, we decided it would be funny to pull off all the laundry bags from the doors that were full of clothes with labeled forms that listed how many pairs of socks, 2, how many t-shirts, 3, and we proceeded to run down the hall yelling with these laundry bags. In an effort to take this crazy stunt higher, we found a bunch of open doors as people were partying in the hotel, and we threw the clothes off the balconies. There was a tiny river below as well, so some of these people's clothes went straight into the water and who knows where from there, but gone, most likely. Other garments just lay on the grass and the rocks below, but we kept going. And hungry for more anarchy, I turned to the other kids and said, "Let's go to the floor below and see what's there!" And we all ran downstairs like we were in the Warriors movie. And sure enough, there was another buffet of plastic bags with threaded yarn handles hanging from the knobs of more rooms. We grabbed everything in a blind, crazy fury, and we went back upstairs and started throwing again. All of a sudden, I pulled out a pair of sandals and I threw one, and then this sick feeling rushed over me. And I asked myself, what will this person wear on their feet? As if clothes were disposable, but footwear was too far. My conscience went up in flames, and I retreated and started watching everyone from the back of the room as if I was watching this all on TV instead of being a culprit and an instigator. I felt sick. I knew immediately this was so wrong, and I hated myself. I don't remember what I did after that, but soon I was back in my room, still in the process of having a talking to with myself, and I swore that I would never fuck anyone over like that again. This haunts me, not only because I will never forgive myself or chalk it up to on-the-loose 11-year-old behavior, but also, to this day, my clothes have a tendency to just disappear. I kid you not, if I fall in love with an old t-shirt from the flea market, I can guarantee you it will be gone in a few weeks or months at best. All of my clothes get up, grow legs, and disappear one by one. Every one of my friends has deemed my closet poltergeist because clothes go in and then disappear. My one friend Kent said that I should tie tennis balls, like in the movie, to all my clothes so that I can pull them out again when they go missing. During my time of making 2 babies, nothing fit for 3 years, so to make room in my closet, I put everything in storage. 4 or 5 giant moving boxes full of clothes. I went in a few weeks ago to pull it all out because I'm sort of finally back to my normal self, pending a few kangaroo pouches and rolls, and all the boxes were gone. Vanished. I also lost all of my clothes in my house fire years ago. I'm telling you that I cannot keep clothes, and I am convinced it is my karma from that night in Munich. And you know what? I say to myself, okay, you probably deserve it. I really am so sorry and remorseful. And I am positive that what I'm wearing right now will probably be gone by the time anyone ever hears this. India. When I was a child, I had this reoccurring dream. I believed it took place in India. I just knew it. There was no convincing me otherwise. I was always intimidated by the dream, but I knew the dream had meaning, and it was not just some silly vision. The dream goes like this. I am hovering above an everlasting desert landscape of goldish-colored sand. I am gliding over it in my perspective. I am not flying. It is the view from a tiny pearl-colored propeller plane. It is an opalescent vessel that is gently coming in for its landing in the middle of this flat, unending desert. Then the dream cuts to a shot looking at the plane from the side. It is on the ground, and all of a sudden, the door of the airplane opens. It's the kind that folds down, unrolling open. Then, about 10 men in white outfits start coming out of the plane. They are all in white, wearing something like Indian quarter pajamas, long sleeping shirts that go to their knees and light pants underneath. And they all have white turbans on as well. They all start in a graceful manner out of the plane in single file, and they walk to a hole in the ground. The hole is a perfectly cut rectangular hole, about 10 feet wide and about 20 feet long. The men gather around the edge of the opening, leaving the top of the rectangle space unoccupied. And then the perspective goes back to the plane and one last man walks out. He is holding a golden urn. And then he too walks over to the open space and stands there with purpose. Then the shot rises gracefully up overhead, glides up over the men, hovers for a moment, and then plummets straight down into the hole, making the whole image fade to black. Now, I am not in this dream. Everything I described is what I see, and the dream has never changed. What does this mean? I don't know. I don't specialize in dream analysis, and I didn't want it clinically or haphazardly dissected by some whack job. This was my little dream, and I wanted to keep it to myself. I was nervous about the whole death angle, there being a burial-like ritual and an urn. But I also didn't want to say for sure the dream was about death. Truthfully, I was like, one day, I'm going to India, and I might die there. But I also knew that my dream would not stop me from going one day. Years later, I landed in the middle of the night in bustling New Delhi. The sounds, the smell, it was the crazy chaos. You would think times 1,000. I was 35 years old, single, and a little lost in life. Flossie had just died, and I was to meet a man named Shantam Seth, who was a friend of a friend, and he was going to take me around to some places and be my guide. The goal was no tourist surface shit. We dove into this wild place. He grabbed my hand, removed my shoes, and looked into my eyes, and down the rabbit hole we went. I had waited for this my whole life. When I was a teenager, I read all these books on religion and really got into Eastern philosophy. Taoism, Buddhism, animism, I read everything. I was just a novice trying to grasp ways in which people could maintain the mentality that we are all one. There was a desire in me to believe that people have extraordinary destinies and that, after all, most of our heroes in life are human beings. We can have faith in those people, and just as important, we can be heroes too. We all have the capacity to be divine, but that damn ego always lets some people think that they are bigger or better than others. However, I think that nature does not choose who is safe or who gets to live. It's an even playing field out there when a tidal wave or an earthquake comes along. On the other hand, I don't want to get bogged down in a defeatist feeling that we are insignificant. I have to believe in an ability to do large things in small ways or small things in large ways. I was not raised in any pious setting, to say the least, but I love faith. I love that people have it. I love anything that gives purpose or unites us, without judgment, of course. So here I was, Shantam took me to several places of worship so that I could experience the different cultures and beliefs right in their very houses, churches, mosques, and temples. One Jain, one Sikh, one Muslim, and one Shiva. They all put me in a space of awe, and I was grateful to be able to really feel what these rooms stored inside them. I sat through several ceremonies and prayer sessions. I would pray. I would listen. We walked through huge boxes of water where one's feet would be cleansed before going in, but the water was covered in flies. Western girl, I just had to get over it and deal. On foot again in the city, I followed the sounds and the sights of what seemed like a groovy old Bollywood movie theater. I have sat in the temples of movie theaters my whole life. I wanted to take Shantam into one of my churches, so I grabbed his hand and we snuck in. It was raw and dusty with rickety old seats a million miles away from Hollywood Stadium seating. As we sat there in the dark with all these particles of dust illuminated by the light of the projector, I had a true Sullivan's Travels moment. As far as film is concerned, I truly believe in the movie Sullivan's Travels. Its message is of most importance. It's about a filmmaker who makes big comedies and he feels empty and he wants to make a film of depth and substance. So he decides to go out into the world and seek misery and pain and suffering so that he can capture them on film purely and honestly. So the man finds it. He ends up, through mistaken identity, being thrown into a very harsh prison. After being in there for a while, one night, the inmates get the privilege of watching a film. It turns out to be a cartoon. While the inmates are watching, they start laughing. The whole crowd just starts roaring. And when he watches them forget about their problems for just one moment, he sees the power of making people laugh. And this filmmaker has the most extraordinary epiphany. He realizes that there is as much merit in trying to ease people's suffering for a moment as there is in focusing on it. To ease someone's pain through a distracting, silly, joyous laugh is his lesson. I know there is suffering, so to escape it for a second is truly powerful. That is one church I am staying loyal to, the Church of Laughing. When we left the theater and continued around the tight alleyways and brightly lit main streets, we ducked into another house of worship. Standing in the church, I turned to Shantam and simply said, "I am afraid." He looked at me. "I'm 35 and I don't know exactly where my life is heading, and I just don't even know what I'm looking for." And he said to me, "There should be no I in what you are saying or thinking or feeling. You have to separate yourself from yourself. You have to realize that you are nothing and we are all everything." I loved this, and I eagerly awaited his next sentence. He looked at me with an easy but true connection and said, "We are all part of everything. You are the sunshine and the air and a flower in a field. You and all of us are in the thread of these clothes. Everything is alive and connected." It's empowering and humbling. Being a lover of animism, to believe all things have a soul, I wanted to feel a part of the universe. But for now, I was excited at this notion here in buzzing, bustling New Delhi, where life and chanting and cooking and cars and bikes and beautiful chaos were all around. Here in this Shiva temple, they painted my forehead red, and I had a scarf on my head, and I was starting to shed my Western self. I still didn't know what I believed in, but to believe in anything that makes you go beyond yourself is key. All my studies as a teenager were starting to coalesce. The guru and I had a meal after my teaching and an auspicious trek through the city, and we ate in contentment and ease. Our energies meshed. We had started the day at around 2 p.m., and at midnight, when our legs were tired, our bellies finally full, and my heart beaming with all the doors this man had opened, we finally said good night. The next day, he took me through transcendental meditation, 3 hours of eyes closed with no movement allowed, traveling in your mind to wherever you want to go. I have to admit, for the first hour, I was so uncomfortable, I went from eager student to let me the hell out of this now. My legs hurt, my back hurt, and I was actually mad. I may have signed up for this, but I wanted out. I don't actually know what kept me in, pride, perhaps, but I stuck with it. And as I cursed him for throwing me into something that was way too advanced for a valley girl like me, I started to picture myself as a bird. What kind of bird do you want to be? I asked myself. An eagle. Why not? Let's get majestic, I thought. And so I took off, gliding higher and higher. I started to fly, and all of a sudden, my legs didn't hurt so much, and I soared above New Delhi, then India. Then I thought about all the places I wanted to go, and everything was endless and full of possibility. I soared over the whole world and looked in on my friends. It was amazing. Most important, it taught me that we are anything but tethered. We are capable of going anywhere we want, anytime we need. Afterwards, I had dinner with Shantam's family and ate his wife's food and played with his two daughters. It was so comforting in his home. I may have wondered where my life was going, but for this moment, life was perfect here in India. After that, I got on a plane and flew to Bhutan and traveled through the whole country for a few weeks, then back to India for a while. When it was time for me to go home, I started the long journey at the airport in Rajasthan. When they called our flight over the loudspeaker, the other passengers and I got up and made our way to the plane outside. Okay, here it goes. I walked out onto the tarmac, and sitting there was a small, pearl-colored white propeller plane, just like in my dream. I stopped walking and literally went paralyzed. So this was it, the moment of truth. I looked around. It being the last flight out, the sun was starting to set. And when I say sunset, I'm talking golden movie hour. God time, nature showing off. It was gold. This was the anticipated scenario I had been wondering about all my life. I took a deep, chalky breath and decided to face the great unknown. My knees were wobbly and I felt dizzy. What the hell was I doing? The engines roared and we started to take off. The amount of time that had passed had caused the gold of the sun to set to its most perfect pink, like a cocktail you get on holiday, blush, or the inside of a seashell. It was as picturesque as anything I have ever seen. Of course it's going to be picturesque. I'm possibly going to die. We took off. And as we made our way into the sky, I watched the sun, my eyes burning and my throat hollow. I had palpitations in my heart and it was full tilt panic. All the meditation in the world was not helping me now. I looked like an animal that knew its unfortunate fate, wide-eyed, trembling, I started craning my neck looking for that bar cart, knowing full well they don't sling cocktails during takeoff. Oh, God. I was actually rocking back and forth in my seat. The motion was either going to soothe me or get me dizzier so I could just pass out. I was a living promotion for Xanax. I looked out the window again. I was so struck by the magnificent beauty of the sunset. I just sat there, quiet. The silence allowed me to ask myself, what if I did get the chance to live life all over again? What would I do differently? What would I keep? And what would I leave? My older self was welcoming my younger self into an early womanhood. This wasn't the death dream it might have seemed like for all of those years. It was rebirth. I realized right then and there that in life, you have to make your dreams come true, even if they are just the ones you have to figure out. I went from terrified to optimistic. The plane leveled out, and so did I. Post-pardon me. I am braless. And not in a sexy activist kind of way, but more of a sexless schlump who justifies to myself that sweatpants are a uniform rather than a cozy private luxury. I am a mother of two girls. Olive is 3 and Frankie is 1.5 years. I am an extremely hands-on overachieving mom, and yet I work too. I am also a wife. None of this is in any order, because anyone who has these responsibilities knows that it is a juggling act. I feel even balancing act doesn't really explain the circus of trying to do all of these things. I have been in trouble for saying women can't have it all. Things have to give if you really want to raise your kids, because it is all-consuming. It's not that you have to give everything up. That's the great news. But you can't do everything at the same time. Being a mother is about sacrifice, putting someone else before you. And that includes one's schedule and workload and play mode and sleep mode and creative juices mode. Inspiration was really hard for me to get back after I had my babies, because all thoughts were about them. I remember after I had Olive, I couldn't even think about work. It made me angry. Work felt like a bad man tempting me to be unfaithful to my kids. Or sometimes I just couldn't take anyone seriously, as if they were crazy to think anything was relevant or important compared to keeping a child alive. Oh, really? That has to get done right away? Well, you're an idiot for caring, was my inner dialogue as anyone tried to discuss work with me. I just didn't care anymore, which was liberating because I had been a workaholic my whole life, but also scary because I need to make a living to raise my children, and I wondered if I would ever actually want to work again. Would the pleasure or motivation ever return? I dedicate myself to my kids the majority of the time. So when I take time in my day or week to work, I feel torn. It takes me hours to unplug from the laser focus I have with my kids. Then the guilt comes in. I should be with them. And unless I have pulled a 5-day marathon with them on my own, I don't ever leave the house without feeling like a total piece of crap. I know that I am not the deadbeat parent I am whipping myself over. I am an insanely involved, loving mother, obsessed with my priorities always being in the right place. I would do anything and everything with and for my kids. But sometimes when I'm at the pony park or the bouncy ball place, there is a little miniature devil on my shoulder after a few days that screams, "You have to give an hour or two to work." And then I feel bad that I totally didn't work hard enough that week because I wanted to make sure that my kids get woken up by me, get their breakfast from me, get to their weekly activities and music class and art class with me. It seems like men don't do this to themselves, and women are just nuts when it comes to their parenting. Speaking of men, at some of these mommy and me groups I go to, it's like a penis measuring contest over who is the most involved mother. I swear. And then I start to reject that. I can do that by myself, but I rebel in a group environment. I'd rather sit with my kids at my own house and play with Play-Doh and glitter art and order pancakes from Olive's store than feel like I have to compete with anyone. I feel like I don't fit in totally with the overbearing mother crowd as much as I want to be the world's best mom. And yet, I know that we're all on the same team to get it right. The conflict, it seemed to reach the loudest hysteria in my head after Frankie, was when I went back to work right away. I didn't get to have the standard maternity leave. I went straight back in and did a film, which is the thing I have struggled with the most. And I had three-day weekends, and I still felt like the world's worst mom, and kind of vowed to really take even more time off acting. I was already doing one film every year or two, and I even took 3 years off, but here I had moved the family to London, and I was experiencing postpartum depression for the first time. I didn't have that with Olive. I had the everyone is stupid for caring about anything, and I don't want to do anything but be with my baby feeling. But eventually, like in slow motion, sound comes back in and the focus gets clear, and all of a sudden, you start putting one foot in front of the other. You get the, oh my, I actually just got a creative idea, or I made a phone call about something. I started getting involved again, although life carries on without you, and I had an insecurity of jumping back in and wondering if I had anything to contribute. It took a while, like physical therapy after an accident is what I equated going back to work after a baby to. One step at a time, working towards some kind of recovery, knowing that everything might not be the same. This time, with my second baby, I just felt like a failure on every level. I also wasn't just trying to make everything perfect with one kid. I was trying to keep my oldest happy and keep her feeling like number one while there was an invader to her throne crawling around. Was I giving enough to my new baby? How much do I just listen to everyone when they say it's most important to keep the older one happy because the younger one doesn't realize what is happening? Really? Because my Olive is misindependent and my little one is a stage 5 clinger and cries if I even leave the room, which I love because Olive is so strong-willed and wants what she needs only when she needs it, and Frankie wants all the mushy love I have to give. It seems to me like my children both need me equally, even if their needs are different. So unless I become a human octopus or divide myself up like a pizza, nothing will get my best. I will just be trying to do everything but poorly and filled with anxieties. And so I continued the film because I had committed to it, and I gave it my all, but I noticed that my pandering Labrador acting style wasn't there because I wasn't totally there. I was older all of a sudden, and it started showing up in my performance. I had done a lot of romantic comedies, which were so fun, and then Grey Gardens, which was this whole other level of commitment. In Grey Gardens, I shut out the world for months in complete and total isolation to truly become this icon. But with where my life was at with a family, I knew that would never be possible again. All of the sudden, in my performance, I felt like I was actually doing something that felt less juvenile and desperate. Not to poo-poo what I have done, but there has always been an air of little girl to my work, and all of the sudden, I was a woman who could take it or leave it. I was happy that this was different. The reason I decided to do this film, called Miss You Already, in the first place was because my husband, my partner Chris Miller, and my agent Peter Levine all said I should. Three men I love. And the irony is, this was a female movie through and through, but it transcends and touches people because it's a great story about two lifelong best friends. And one is trying to make a baby, and one is dying of cancer. So the whole cycle of life told in this love story between these two women has such poetry and strength that I wanted to be a part of it. When they gave it to me to read, I turned the pages of the script with Frankie in my arms and Olive in her high chair. I would make breakfast for them and be sobbing as I read one page here and one page there because it was so moving. I told Peter, I didn't even have time to read this. How was I going to do this? And he and my husband vowed to help make it work. And so here we were. My partner in the film was also a woman I could not respect and admire more, Toni Collette. I think she has given some of the greatest performances of our generation. And she was playing Millie, the woman who gets cancer, and I was playing Jess, the woman trying to get through everything to start her family. I was to be pregnant through much of the movie too, and just having had a baby, that worked out well. But much more important, I kept wanting to be a part of this because all of the women who are most important in my life have lost someone important to them to cancer. My beloved Nancy lost her mom. My mother-in-law Coco lost her mother, who was her hero and best friend. When Coco read the script, she said, I am so proud of you for doing this. And I felt like a little girl who had done something right. It was the kind of praise that silenced all the demons that plague me. My personal mantra, strangely enough, comes from The Simpsons. There is an episode called And Maggie Makes Three. In it, all of the family is looking through a photo album, and there are pictures of Marge and Bart and Lisa. And then the kids ask, why are there no pictures of Maggie? And so it tells the story of how when Homer was working at the power plant, he wasn't happy. Every day he worked in an octagonal room looking at an Orwellian plaque that read, don't forget you're here forever. And one day when Homer came home, he told Marge that he was afraid his whole life was slipping away without ever getting to live his dream, which was to run a bowling alley. And so they all squeezed financially and made it work, and Homer finally got his dream job. He became so happy. His life fell into place with his wife and two kids, and then suddenly Marge became pregnant. Now, of course, in order to earn the living his family needed, he had to go back to work at the power plant. And so he did. But at the end of the episode, the kids say, yes, but why are there still no pictures of Maggie in this photo album? And Homer says it's because he keeps her pictures where he needs them the most. And it cuts back to his office, and they are all taped up in front of him on the plaque for inspiration. But the way he has taped all the pictures of Maggie on the plaque, it has covered some of the words, and it now reads, do it for her. And that is now what he sees every day. Do it for her. That is it. You show them that you love them endlessly. You devote yourself. You sacrifice. You parent also by example. The way you live and the things you achieve and the way you behave will be more evident than trying to convince them of anything. I am a stay-at-home mom some days and a working mom others, but I am always first and foremost a mom. When we mothers worry or guilt trip ourselves or try to convince ourselves we will ever be the same after having kids, we are missing the point because we won't be the same. I feel like I was born the day my kids were, and that my life before was only there to gain wisdom for them. The point is, you do your best. You do your best every day. You do it, and you do it for them. The Royal Hawaiian. I first met my grandfather when I was around 2 years old. His name was Shunny. He and his second wife, Marta, lived in Pennsylvania, where my mother was from. My mother was not born there because she was born in a post-war displaced persons camp in Germany. That was also where Shunny met Marta and left his wife, my grandmother, and my mother's mother, to be with Marta. But according to what my mom told me, the marriage was over long before that, and the camp forced my grandfather to think differently. He wanted to be happy, and so the family immigrated to Pennsylvania when they got out, and then everyone went their separate ways.